Welcome to AFP Audio, and I'm talking with Dr. Kirsten Campbell, who's an endocrinologist at the Department of Endocrinology, Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Adelaide in South Australia. Welcome, Kirsten.
Hi, Kat.
And thanks for your article, Evaluating and Managing Patients with Thyrotoxicosis, in the most recent issue of AFP. Now, Table 1 in the article is an excellent summary of the causes of thyrotoxicosis. What are the most common causes?
So in the Australian population and comparable to the rest of the world as well, Graves' disease and toxic multinodular goiter are the most common causes of thyrotoxicosis, with the latter becoming more common with increasing age. But there are certainly other important causes of thyrotoxicosis to consider, such as toxic adenoma and thyroiditis being the other common causes.
A number of different causes of thyroiditis in the table as well.
Yeah. So certainly postpartum thyroiditis is common for women. And then there's painless sporadic thyroiditis and painful subacute thyroiditis that are also relatively common, and drug-induced thyroiditis, most commonly from amiodarone, can also be seen.
And what are the common clinical features of thyrotoxicosis that a GP might see?
So there's a wide spectrum of manifestations that a patient may present with, but the most common symptoms would be palpitations, fatigue, weight loss, although some people do gain weight, nervousness and heat intolerance, sweating would be the most common symptoms that patients would report. In terms of signs that you might find, I think tachycardia is a common manifestation, as is restlessness and agitation. The patient may also have a tremor on examination and be hyperreflexic. And then there's more specific findings that you may find in the setting of Graves' disease, such as Graves' ophthalmopathy and the features of that. I guess the other thing to mention is that elderly patients often present with more non-specific features, so to have a higher index of suspicion in that population.
Okay. And to evaluate, so if a GP has a patient who they think may have thyrotoxicosis, what are the basic sort of tests they might consider ordering?
Mm-hmm. So if you're suspecting thyroid disease, a TSH is your number one investigation, and that should be low suppressed in the setting of thyrotoxicosis, and then some labs will go on then to perform free thyroid hormone assay, free T4 and free T3, but sometimes you have to specifically request that, and it's worth requesting both because sometimes the free T3 can be elevated and the free T4 will be normal. From that point where you've diagnosed thyrotoxicosis, you're then on the hunt for the underlying etiology, and I guess to be succinct, the thyroid scan is what's going to give you the highest diagnostic yield, but doesn't have to be requested in all patients to determine the underlying cause.
And what other tests might be useful if a thyroid scan isn't ordered, what other tests might be useful?
So firstly, the clinical evaluation of the patient is always important. For example, in the postpartum setting, you're looking at Graves' disease versus postpartum thyroiditis in general, and following the time course of that might give you the diagnosis. If you've got two blood tests 3-4 weeks apart and the patients then become euthyroid or hypothyroid, you would suspect thyroiditis perhaps over Graves' disease in that setting. So I think the clinical scenario is important to consider. TSH receptor autoantibodies are also important. And I think that in the future we'll probably see that these are used more frequently to diagnose Graves' disease. And they're certainly useful in some groups where you'd be trying to avoid a thyroid scan, such as pregnant women or women who are breastfeeding.
And ultrasound's not used particularly much in thyrotoxicosis?
No, not useful for diagnosing the underlying cause for thyrotoxicosis. And the other thyroid auto antibodies, thyroid peroxidase and thyroglobulin antibodies, don't tend to be particularly useful for diagnosing the cause of thyrotoxicosis, except perhaps in the setting of thyroiditis, it can be a useful test in that setting.
In the next section of the article, and I'd just direct readers to table three, other than symptomatic treatment with a beta blocker or, if not tolerated, a calcium channel blocker, you describe the management of Graves' disease and three treatment options. What are they?
As you know, in the article, we chose to focus on the management of Graves' disease, but the management of thyrotoxicosis will vary slightly with each different cause. So it's important to make sure you've got the correct diagnosis before launching down the management pathway. But for Graves' disease, the
and I
three
suppose that would be in special, and the management would be in the specialist world anyway. GP
yeah,
is unlikely to be managing Graves' disease, at least initially.
So with Graves' disease, the three main treatment options are, antithyroid medication, radioactive iodine, or thyroidectomy. And certainly in Australia, the first line treatment is generally with antithyroid medication. In some countries, radioactive iodine would be the first line management. And thyroidectomy is generally reserved for patients who perhaps present with a large goiter, or they've got moderate to severe active eye disease, and you want to be avoiding radioactive iodine in that setting, or perhaps an operation is indicated for another reason, such as you're considering an underlying thyroid cancer or there's hyperparathyroidism present. So the first line management in Australia is generally with antithyroid medication.
And which one's the top pick usually?
So the choice is between carbimazole and prothiouracil, and carbimazole is the first, the drug treatment of choice for several reasons. It's got a longer half-life, so when given 20 milligrams or less, it can be given once a day. It's also more effective, and in more recent years, it's come to light that prothiouracil can be associated with severe liver injury. So for that reason as well, carbimazole is usually first line. Prothiouracil is used in the setting of pregnancy, and it's generally given for the first trimester because carbimazole has been associated with congenital malformations when given during that period.
What's the success rate of getting remission from antithyroid drugs?
Yes, I mean, that is the problem with antithyroid drugs, in that in Australia, approximately a third to a half of patients will achieve long-term remission. So the remainder of patients can have a recurrence of their Graves' disease in time. Generally, that occurs sort of within 6 months of stopping that medication, but can occur any time thereafter. So we generally give antithyroid drugs for 12 to 18 months, and then stop them and observe the patient, and only a third to a half will remain in long-term remission. In those patients who have recurrent disease, we would then be recommending a definitive treatment option, whether that be radioactive iodine, and that would be in preference, and the other option though would be a thyroidectomy.
And what about for Graves' ophthalmopathy? What are the treatments that make that worse or make it better?
So with Graves' ophthalmopathy, certainly with active, moderate to severe eye disease, you would want to be avoiding radioactive iodine because that can be associated with an exacerbation of eye disease. An occasional patient develops it for the first time when given radioactive iodine. So for that group of patients, you would either choose antithyroid medication, or if they've got recurrent disease, you may recommend a thyroidectomy for that type of patient. Those with mild active eye disease may be given radioactive iodine, but you would want to provide them with prednisolone prophylaxis for approximately 2 to 3 months after the radioactive iodine therapy.
You state that radioactive iodine therapy is generally quite well tolerated.
Yeah, it is well tolerated. There are some patients who will get a slight exacerbation of their thyrotoxicosis, which generally we pre-treat with antithyroid medication, and that attenuates that response. Otherwise, it is generally well tolerated. There are some radiation safety precautions that the patients have to follow afterwards, and it's important to counsel them in regards to this. It includes for, depending on the dose, but for days to up to 1 to 2 weeks after the dose, they need to follow some precautions such as avoiding sleeping with their partner and avoiding close contact with young children, etc.
Well, thanks so much for your article and for talking to AFP Audio today.
No problem.
Thanks, Kirsten. See you later.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.